Part of our scripture reading time. Today we're going to continue our jaunt through the book of John, our read through the book of John. I've told you from the very beginning, LTC this year, Leadership Training for Christ, our kiddos, the theme is the book of John. And so our kids have been reading through John, they've been working through it, they've been doing Bible Bowl and stuff with it, and so I wanted to take the church kind of on a trip through John. Now there's 21 chapters in John, and I'm only preaching like 11 times or something like that, so we're not going to get through the entire book. So we're kind of having to pick and choose, but today we're going to be in the 13th chapter of the book of John. So if you'll get your Bibles open to that area, we're going to look at the 13th chapter of the book of John this morning as we work our way on through John. Now I'll tell you what, John, the first time I ever had a Bible, I think the first time I can remember, I'm sure as a kiddo in Bible class, we talked about the book of John and we did things. First time I remember studying the book of John was in Vienna, Austria. We were on a college exchange program and we were there for about 3 or 4 months, and our professor, John Fletcher, was the professor, and he was teaching the Bible class and he had picked out John. His name was John. I think that's why he picked the book of John. And so we studied it. And that was the first time we really dove into it, and I was fascinated by the stories. I am a very slow reader. Do I have slow readers out here? Who are our slow readers? Yeah, okay, so you know who you are. I'm a very slow reader, and so John was great because it was action from the start, right? I mean, Matthew hits you face first with a list of genealogies. You know, I mean, like, I'm like, who begot, and these names that you can't even read. Man, John just starts the running at the start and busts out of the gate, and it's just super fast. And so I've always loved the book of John. It's been one of my favorites, and as we go through it again this year, I'm reminded again, as I always am when I read through John, about how much I enjoy it. I need to take a moment here just a second, because I just realized I didn't do this earlier. I wanted to introduce real quick to you a couple people. I think they're still in here. Our kiddos this weekend, as I said, they were staying at the Birdwells and at Janet and Michelle, the Thompson's house, over the weekend, but they had some college leaders who came up and worked with us as well. The girls, Christy Ferguson, of course, everybody knows Christy back in the back. You can wave, Christy. She was one of our college leaders, and Brianne Largent helped her with the girls this week. And then we also had Dakota Gilbert. Dakota's back here in the back. He's sitting back here beside the Davises. Dakota is a student down at SFA. He's a pre-med student, actually, and getting a minor in biblical studies, I think you said, yeah, as well. And so anyway, he works with Scotty. He's down at the Yellow House sometimes with Scotty Spate. And so I called Scotty, and Scotty said, I've got someone for you. I'm going to send you Dakota. And I called Dakota, and I was like, okay, are you up for spending a whole weekend with a bunch of middle school and high school? And he said, I'm your man. And I thought, this kid is either naive or maybe he's real serious. But anyway, he's had a good time. He's been a great asset to us this weekend. They have been leading Bible studies with our kiddos. You'll notice their shirts that say revival, not survival. And that has been the theme of the week, and that's what they've been studying. And so I appreciate them being up here. I wanted to say thank you and let you know who those folks were who have helped us out this weekend. So, John chapter 13. A little bit of background here before we get into this. Of course, John is telling the story of Jesus, and he tells it in a way that's unique to John. We have the synoptic gospels that we talk about, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and synoptic comes from that word that's kind of synced, the same word that says synced. So they're all kind of all in sync with each other, the same, pretty much same stories, pretty much same chronology. John is the rebel. One person wrote the maverick gospel, John. He's a little bit out there. He's different. He writes from a different style, from a different, almost different purpose, and probably a different time period. John was written quite a bit later than the other Gospels. And so he is writing probably the first book that was written to a second generation group of Christians, people who maybe 20, 30 years removed from the time of Christ. And so you had a new generation of Christians who had been taught by Christians. Probably scholars agree this is probably who he was writing to. So He takes some assumptions. He takes some liberties in terms of assuming what people already know. He doesn't hit all of the things that the Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John accounts do, but he tells it in a little bit different way. And so we get this vibrant gospel, this story that's much more alive in my mind. Not to take anything away from Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Get to heaven and they're going to go, Matthew, Mark, and Luke's going to go, what are you saying about us down there? This is not to take anything away from that. It's just a different style that he is writing. And so so we get the story from the very beginning. Of course, John starts out with the Word. In the beginning was the Word. He harkens back to the Genesis time. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. The Word was God. And he says, the Word became flesh. And off to the races John goes in teaching and talking about the story of Jesus. So today, in today's reading, we're going to get to the time when they are finally in Jerusalem for the last time. Okay, he has been in Jerusalem at least twice already, during Passover, in fact. Two separate Passovers, he was around the area, but this is the third time he's going to be there, and this time is going to be his last time. Now, John does not tell the story of the Last Supper. He does not give us the blow-by-blow account of the final meal with Jesus and the breaking of the bread and the wine. And he doesn't give us the things, the story that we base, in fact, our Lord's Supper time on. He doesn't actually tell us about the meal. Although everything about the meal and the purpose of that meal and everything that's going on, he does tell us about, but he doesn't tell us about the meal, the way Matthew, Mark, and Luke do. It's kind of an interesting scenario. So we find ourselves getting to the upper room. If you'll recall, the apostles, they've traveled back to Jerusalem. He raised Lazarus. They went down to Bethany first, and they were really like, Jesus, we don't need to be going down there. They're looking to you know, they're going to attack you and stuff. And he says, this is exactly where I have to be. And so through chapters 10 and 11 and 12, he's traveling. He travels back down toward the Judea into the Jerusalem area, and he's in Bethany, and he finally goes into Jerusalem. And just a few days earlier, we're told that he comes in a triumphant way, right? That they have the donkey. He's riding a donkey, and people are celebrating him as the coming king, and they're putting down the palm leaves and things as he rides into town. It's a huge celebration. Now, the apostles, this inner core of followers that he has with him at the time, his disciples, his apostles, we're going to call them eventually, they know something is coming. They know something big is on the horizon. Now, they are expecting a revolution. They are expecting some major upheaval. They are expecting that the people who celebrated him coming in Jerusalem, the popularity is going to continue to grow, and the fervor is going to grow, and eventually they're going to rise up with arms in the streets and declare him king. And he will overthrow the oppressors, namely the Roman governments. He's going to throw out the corrupt people in the Sanhedrin, the religious leaders who are really just banking on money and not banking on the Bible, on the scriptures. He's going to turn things around, and he's going to lead the nation of Israel back to its glory days in the time of David. That's what the apostles have in mind. And Jesus keeps talking about dying. It's kind of like if you were on the campaign of a president, and he was a presidential campaign, and someone coming, they're going to run for president, and all along the campaign trail, he keeps talking about how he's going to lose. And you're like, Jesus, zip it. Stop with the negativity. You can't die. That's not going to work. You see, the apostles, their idea of what was going to happen, they had great plans. Jesus had different plans. Because his rise to power, his overthrowing the powers that be, was going to be completely different than what they had in mind. And we start to see that happen right here in chapter 13. Now, it's been building up. And John has been dropping hints all along the way, and the miraculous signs and the things that are going to come. And in fact, Jesus, he quotes Jesus as starting to tell them openly, I am going to die. They're going to kill me. And the apostles are like, well, just, this does not make sense. This can't be the way it is. So we see this scene. The upper room has been prepared. It's Passover. John tells us it's the time of Passover. And if you remember, every time John tells us about a festival or a season that's going on, it's very important. In fact, everything that John says is really important. John doesn't miss a beat. I mean, he's telling us something for a reason every single time. And so once again, he tells us it's Passover time. And every previous festival of the Passover festival previously, or the festival of the tabernacles. Remember I built that tabernacle up on stage, or that kind of a mini tabernacle on stage one day. Every time there's a festival and John talks about it, Jesus uses that festival to apply to himself. How does that festival become what he is doing, or how does he become part of what that festival is trying to explain? And so once again, John starts off the chapter 13 with, it's Passover time. And so people have streamed into Jerusalem. Set the scene for you. They've streamed into Jerusalem. The population swelled to probably over 1 million people. People from all across Israel coming to celebrate the Passover together. You remember the Passover festival? Passover was celebrating the night that they all fled from Egypt. That God told Moses to tell the people, through Aaron, tell the people to take a lamb that was unblemished, slaughter it, cook it, eat it with your clothes on, make sure it's all gone by the morning, take the blood of the lamb and pour and spread over your door frame, so that night when the angel of death came through the camps, came through the entire nation of Israel, of Egypt, he would slaughter the firstborn of everyone. But if there was blood on the door frame, they would pass over that house. And the next morning, there was death everywhere, and the Israelites, finally Pharaoh said, leave and leave us now. And the children of Israel got up and fled, or left captivity with Moses. And so this celebration happened every year. And the people would gather together in their families, and they would take a lamb, and they would slaughter the lamb, and they would eat it, and they would put blood on their door frame, and they would recount the stories. They would recount the story of the Exodus. And it usually started at the table. The youngest boy in the family would ask the father, Father, why is tonight special? Tell me the story of why tonight is special. And the story would begin over the meal, and they would talk about this time. And so Jesus tells his apostles, he said, I long to eat this Passover with you. He knew something was coming. He knew what was about to happen. And so the room had been prepared, and the apostles and Jesus, they head toward the house. And we don't hear it in John, but in the chapter, in the account of Luke tells us that as they enter into the room where they're going to have this meal. Now, scholars disagree on this. Is it the actual final Passover meal, or is it the meal before? They had several meals up until Passover, and they were kind of ceremonial meals. We're not really sure. There's some debate on that. Some people are real firm on one, some are real firm on the other. It doesn't necessarily matter, I guess, but just so you know, they're coming in to have this formal meal at the Passover time. It's certainly, if it's not the Passover meal, it's certainly in their brains what's going on. And as they come into the room, the apostles are arguing. Luke tells us they're arguing about who is going to be the greatest. Right? Now I guess that makes sense. They're in the presence of the Messiah, someone they believe is going to be the king forever for Israel. And they're in the close-knit circle. They're like in the inner circle of this guy. They're all friends with him. And they want to know who's going to be second in command. Who's going to be Secretary of War? Who's going to be Secretary of State? Who's going to be Vice President? You know, that's kind of their thinking. It's not those words, but that's what they're arguing. Who is going to be the most important? Because when he becomes king, where's my role going to be? Right? That's what they're arguing about as they come into the room for the Passover meal with Jesus. Let's look in John chapter 13 and read. And we're going to go ahead and read through the whole passage, and then we're going to come back and pick apart some of these verses here. I'm going to get my glasses because The more I hang out with kids, the less I can see. I don't know what's going on. Okay, John chapter 13. I'm going to be reading from the New English Translation. It's very similar to the NIV. John chapter 13, verse 1. Just before the Passover feast, Jesus knew that his time had come to depart from this world to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he now loved them to the very end. The evening meal was in progress, and the devil had already put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, that he should betray Jesus. Because Jesus knew the Father had handed all things over to him, and that he had come from God and was going back to God, he got up from the meal, removed his outer clothes, and took a towel and tied it around himself. He came to Simon Peter, tied it around himself. He poured the water into the wash basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to dry them with a towel that he had wrapped around himself. Then he came to Simon Peter. Peter said to him, "Lord, are you going to wash my feet?" Sometimes says, "Wash my feet?" What are you doing? Jesus replied, "You do not understand what I am doing now, but you will understand after these things." And Peter said to him, "You will never wash my feet." Jesus replied, "If I do not wash you, you have no share with me." Simon Peter said to him, "Lord, wash not only my feet, but also my hands and my head." Jesus replied, "The one who has bathed needs only to wash his feet, but is completely clean. And you disciples are clean, not every one of you," for Jesus knew that the one who was going to betray him. For this reason, he said, "Not every one of you is clean." So when Jesus had washed their feet and he put on his outer clothing back on, he took his place at the table again and said, "Do you understand what I have done for you? You call me teacher and Lord, and do so correctly, for that is what I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example. You should do just as I have done for you. And I tell you the solemn truth. The slave is not greater than his master, nor is the one who is sent as a messenger greater than the one who sent him. If you understand these things, you will be blessed if you do them." We have this amazing passage of this time in Jerusalem at the Passover, of the man who these apostles have believed and banked their life on, that he is the Messiah. He is the chosen one, the one that God has anointed to rule over Israel. Christ is not his name. That is his royal title. That is what he has come to do. Messiah. Messiah Jesus. And as they sit around this table, Jesus does something radically different than what they expect. Let's look at the first three verses real quick. John is a master of layering three upon three upon three. We talked about this in the very beginning of the chapter, at the very beginning of the book. He's done this several times. But in the very beginning of this chapter, in chapter 13, he layers three upon three. So the first three verses introduces the story of Jesus serving his disciples and washing their feet. But it also introduces the entire rest of the book, because this point, this verse, these three verses in chapter 13 become the pinnacle of John's gospel. Now, this is not the crucifixion that you would think, well, that's the climax of the action. That's probably true too. But right here is when everything turns. This is the moment that John has been pointing us to all the way through the accounts, all the way through the first 12 chapters. He gets to chapter 13, and this becomes the point where he pivots to the end. This is the beginning of the end. This is, finally, Jesus about to do what he has come to do. And so, he has three verses that introduce this passage. And within these three verses, he layers three other things. So in the very first verse, he puts three different things in as well. So let's look at the very first verse, chapter 13, verse 1. Just before the Passover feast. So John starts out by letting you know, hey, this is Passover. This is a special time. It's hard for us to even compare. Thanksgiving, perhaps? It is a meal when the family gets together. They are thankful for what God has done for them, which was rescue them from the Egyptians. But it's a time of tradition, a time of solemnness, a time of remembrance. It's a time that is so wrapped up, and it's a time that Jesus is going to fulfill in himself. Because as we read the rest of the book of John, he begins to explain how Jesus, he's already told us this actually back up in chapter 2, but he's going to tell us again and show us how Jesus becomes our Passover. That Jesus is the lamb that's going to be slaughtered for us. And the blood is not going to be smeared on the door frame, but it's going to be smeared over our hearts. So the death will no longer affect us, but pass over us. And that we may be led from captivity of slavery of sin to a promised land that he has prepared for us. So John starts off with, it's a Passover. The Passover has arrived. In Jesus, he truly has. And he says, Jesus knew that his time had come to depart from this world to the Father. Some versions say, depart from this world and go home to the Father. This is where John started the book with this, right? In the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God. And he talks about the Word becoming flesh and dwelt among men. This is John's whole point. And so here he is at the summit of his book, at the pivot point, and he says, it's Passover. Passover arrived, and Jesus knows his hour has come. He knows the time has arrived in which he will depart from this world and go back to the Father. Now, I want to make real clear here. We want to make sure that we're not assuming, we're not necessarily just talking about his death. Because Jesus did not just die and go back to the Father. Right? Later on, we're told that he is the firstborn of the resurrected. So he did not just die and back up to heaven. He died and then was brought back to life as evidence and a security deposit for us that we too could be brought back to life. And then he spends time with his apostles and then he returns to the Father. So again, we're seeing the beginning of the end, and Jesus knows his time is quickly approaching. He acts this way because he knows these things. Okay, he acts the way he's going to act because of what he already knows. Keep that in your mind because we're going to come back to that. So, the Passover feast, Jesus knew it was time, his time had come. Remember, he told his mother, the very, very beginning, his mother had said, Jesus, the wine is gone, you've got to do something. Use your miraculous powers and do something for this family. And he tells his mother, what does he tell her? What's he tell her? My time has not come. And yet he goes ahead and honors his mother by doing, she says, do exactly what he says to do. Like any mother, right? Do exactly what he says to do. You're going to do this, I'm going to tell you to do this, you're going to obey me. He does what she tells him to do. But he's told her, my time has not yet come. And throughout the book of John, we see his time is not here. And finally, John says, now he knows his time has come. And then the last part of the verse 1, having loved his own who were in the world, he now loved them to the very end. Wow. Wow. Simple words which carry so much meaning. Having loved those who were his own, and he's shown this love through all these signs and miracles and things that he's done, just walking with his apostles, living with his disciples, healing them, reviving them, caring for them, feeding them. He's loved his own, those who have claimed him as Messiah, those who have claimed to be part of him. And now John says, and now, at this point, he begins to love him, to love them to the very end. Now, the word end here is not necessarily the end as in, that's it, we're done, right? We're in. It's over. Finite. Finished. What he means here, the word here really encompasses the idea of completeness. Utmost. He loves them to the fullest extent possible. I saw another writer say, and I really like the way he put this, he said, there was nothing else, nothing more that love could do that he did not do for his apostles. Nothing more could be done with love of God than what Jesus did for his apostles, his disciples, his own. And he's not just loving the people that are in the room. He's loving all who will call and claim to him. To the utmost, to the fullest, to the completeness, to the fulfillment. Later on, Jesus says, I am the end of the law. I have come so that the law can end. The law can be ended in me, can be fulfilled in me. Not just stopped, but it is completely fulfilled, the utmost. Nothing else could love do that wasn't done by Jesus for us at this time. So he loves them to the end. That's three things in the first verse. The first verse. We've got, 15, 20 verses? We're not going to do every one like that, I promise you. That's the first one. So that's the first three, and then he's got three more. So after that, he rolls right into the next two things, because in the midst of love itself, the midst of the greatest love known to man ever possible, starting right here, John says he's loving them to the very end. And look at the very next verse. What is lurking in the midst of the greatest love possible? Now the evening meal is in progress, and the devil had put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot that he should betray Jesus. In the midst of the greatest love possible, we find evil crouching. Now some people would say, "What? God should be bigger than that. Why do we find evil in the midst of love?" But you know what? That's the perfect place to find evil. Hear me out. Evil needs to be surrounded by God. God's love surrounds evil and will conquer it every time. But where we find evil, we will also find God's love. Because that is why Jesus is here. That is why Jesus is here at this moment, in this time. He was sent here because we are evil. We are sent here because we are sinful. And so, where do we find evil? It's where Jesus is surrounding. It's where Jesus is working to the utmost, because he is working to conquer it, working to overcome it. And right in the midst, Satan is already working to combat him. So we have Satan working in Jesus, in Judas Iscariot, and verse number 3, because Jesus knew that the Father had handed all things over to him, and that he had come from God and was going back to God, he got up from the meal. Now, John's real interesting here, because John gives us this statement about Jesus knowing who he was, where he had come from, and that he was going back to God. Okay? John says, look, Jesus knew who he was, he knew where he came from, and he knew where he was going. And we would assume that. This is Jesus. This is God of the universe in the form of his Son here on earth to do his will. We would hope that he knows who he is, that he knows where he came from and where he's going. Absolutely, yes. Right on. And then John says, this is the reason for what he is about to do. This is the reason why he gets up from the meal. This is the reason why he takes off his outer clothing. And this is the reason why he begins to wash the feet of his disciples. Because Jesus knew that the Father had handed all things over to him, and he had come from God and was going back to God, he got up from the meal, removed his outer clothes, took a towel, and tied it around his waist. Vision this with me if you will. He tied the towel around his waist, taking off his clothing. Now, the next time his clothes are going to be removed, they're going to be forcefully removed by Roman soldiers. And it's going to be in preparation for the crucifixion, which he'll be hanging on the cross naked because his clothes have been taken from him. You think Jesus didn't think about that as he self-removes his clothes that last time and lays them down and takes up a complete different outfit, a towel to drape across himself? He didn't have that towel either on. He takes the water
and he pours into the wash bin and begins to wash the disciples' feet. Okay, little history here. Sorry, I've been a big guy, a little history. I'm a historian guy. I love history. This is going to be probably in a room called a triclinium. A triclinium. It's a Roman word for a room, a dining room. Okay? It's probably on the second floor. It may be with couches instead of actually built in. They actually, you can go to Pompeii, you can go to Rome, and you can see some ancient tricliniums that walk in. They'll actually have them set up, and you can see what they're like. But basically, it's a room where people ate. And the room was set up so that you had a U-shaped group of couches, okay? So you'd have a couch that ran here, and a couch that ran here, and a couch that ran here. And in the middle of these three couches, you'd have a table in the center. Kind of a low table. It might be round. It might be square. Kind of depended on what they wanted. But these three couches could be on legs. They would have short little legs, and you kind of they'd be there on. Or they could be built in. Some of the ones in Pompeii are actually built in. They had stone. And so the room kind of came from the side. This little thing came, rose up at a kind of an angle, and then went straight down to the ground. And this was actually concrete or mud that they had built these platforms out of. And on top of these couches, on top of these platforms would be cushions and pillows. Taken, you would lay down on these, on your left-hand side, you'd lay down on these couches or on these pillows, and you would eat from the table that was in the center of the room. Okay? I know I'm not doing this real justice, but you just kind of lay down. I don't want to lay down on the communion table. That might be kind of strange. You kind of lay down on your side, and you would eat. Now, everybody would lay on their left-hand side. So you'd lay here, and the next guy would lay there, and the next guy would lay there. Usually three people per couch, so you could have nine or more. You had more people couches in there. You just kind of arrange it around there, so everybody laid down there, and you kind of leaned in. So you're not sitting at a table. We don't have a table with silverware kind of stuff. We're just kind of leaning in there, and this is the way Romans ate. Kind of interesting. The host of the table of the family, or the host of the meal, would sit here, kind of here. This was the couch for the host. This was the couch for the most important people, usually. And this couch over here was kind of the lowest important people. So it kind of went in order. And the reason for that was the host was here, so the host could see everybody laying on like this, and the food would come in and be served. This end was open so that the servants could come in and put food on the table and take plates away and do kinds of things. And so everybody would sit around there. The host or the most important person would sit here so they could look out of the room. It was usually a courtyard room. You'd look out into the courtyard and see what's going on. This was the worst place over here because you're kind of like over here and you're looking at the most important person, right? That's why you're the least important. You're looking at the most important person. And if you wanted to look at the beautiful scene outside the window, it's real, but they all had all these customs and traditions. And one of the customs and traditions was, of course, washing feet. When you came into the room, you're getting up on top of this couch and you're walking around so you can lay down, and your feet are nasty. Right? They don't have shoes like we have. They've got sandals and there's dirt and all this kind of stuff. So usually you would come in, you'd sit down, and most of the time you'd have washed your hands when you came in yourself, but then you'd sit down on the sofas or the couches and the servants would come in and wash your feet. That's what would happen. In fact, Jesus scolds the Pharisee earlier in the book when he says, "You didn't even wash my feet." Right? Martha is washing my feet with her hair. You didn't even offer to wash my feet. This was a very strict custom. Normally happened all the time. And the person who did it was the lowest of the low. This was the lowest servant in the household. If someone threw up because their meal was not cooked properly, that's the servant that would wash feet, would be the servant that would clean up the vomit. Right? The lowest of the low, that was a servant that washed your feet. And so as Jesus is reclining at the table, the apostles are around, the meal has already started, we don't know if they started eating or not, but at some point Jesus says, "I'm going to wash your feet." And he gets up, and he walks around, he takes off his garments, he puts on his towel, and he gets the basin, and he starts washing the feet of his apostles. Doing the job that the lowest servant in the house would have done. And the apostles seem to be shocked. There's nothing that's said.
We don't know how many he did, but it takes apparently a couple before he comes to Peter. It looks that way, but he comes to Peter before Peter finally says, what are you doing? Right? Peter finally speaks up and says, Peter's often the one that speaks for the group, but no one said a thing while he's getting ready and doing all these things. They're thinking, what is he doing? Why is he acting this way? Well, John tells us why, because Jesus knows who he is, where he came from, and where he's going. And he serves his apostles in a way that is profoundly different than what they are expecting. This is Messiah. This is going to be king. Would King David come up and wash your feet? Absolutely not. In fact, Abigail, who becomes David's wife, eventually, her act of submission to David, when they say, you come and be, we want the king wants you, and she says, I will wash the king's feet. In fact, I will do whatever the king says to do. And yet here, the Messiah, who is going to be king like David, is washing the feet of his apostles. A tax collector. A fisherman. People that don't get that kind of respect. And here's the God of the universe, Son, washing his feet. And he says to them, you don't understand what's going on. You're not going to get this until later on. But you will. Because what I'm doing is giving you an example of what you should do for others. You call me teacher, you call me rabbi. That is correct, Jesus says. And so because your teacher and your rabbi has done this, because your master, your Lord has done this for you, you should do this for someone else. So, here's my point. Because this is less of a sermon, I stink at this. I am horrible at this. And I work at a church full time.
There's something about preachers, I don't know if it's just me, I think it's probably more than just me, but I don't know.
I like getting up and talking. I like people listening to me. I like reading studies and people going, oh, I get it now, oh, that's great. I like sharing things with people. And you know what happens a lot of times? I feel so good. If I leave here and no one says, that was great this morning. Or if I class, someone says, I really enjoyed that lesson. You know what happens when I get home? I'm like, what did I do? It's horrible. Oh, I'm so bad. Oh, I've got to figure out how to do something better.
I stink at this. Because I like the praise of men. And Jesus says, look, you have to serve one another. If the toilet in the men's restroom overflows with poop all over the floor, you know who's going in there to clean it up? Not me. You know what I do? I call this man in the pew right here. I'm like, Dickie, help! Help, Dickie! And he's like, okay, I got it. And he does, and it goes away. Folks, I'm horrible. I'm guessing I'm not the only one, but I hope I'm not. But I don't do this well. And Jesus says, look, I'm giving you an example that you should do this for one another. And it's tough. And I try, and I try, and then I realize, you know why I should be doing it? Because I know where I came from. Because I know where I'm going. And I know who I belong to. That should be my motivation. And I ask for your forgiveness because often it's not enough. I forget it. And I don't think about it. And I wind up doing more harm than good. But I wonder if we as a church, if we as a family of believers, continually focused on serving one another, And let me give you an idea. Let me say this too. It's different than helping and fixing. I'm a fixer. Okay, I'm a fixer. If something needs fixing, I'm your guy. Let me try to fix that. I can call somebody, right? The feet didn't get washed. Jesus didn't call the servant. Jesus didn't go, hey, you guys can get your feet washed. I got my phone right here. Let me call the servant back in here. We'll get your feet washed for you. That's not what he did. That's what I do. That's not what he did. Fixing and helping. And I've had this conversation a few times because it's been on my mind the past couple of weeks after a study we did up in Colorado Springs. Helping and fixing can be done without a relationship. Helping someone and fixing something for someone is done oftentimes because I'm smarter, I know more, right? Someone calls me up and says, Carol says, my computer is not working. And I'm like, I'm your guy. That's me. I can do that. We go over to her house. I open it up. I click, 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 and it works. And she goes, oh, you're so good. And I'm like, yeah, I know. Thank you. Oh, that's so, I appreciate that. And she's like, I don't understand. I'm like, yeah. Now, what's just happened? I'm smarter in my mind. I'm not. Carol's got so much experience on me. It's amazing. But I feel like, you know what? I'm smarter. I'm better. I just helped her. And she's like, what can I give you? Can I pay you for something? You know why she does that? Because we naturally feel indebted to someone who helps us. When I'm not as good and they're better than me and they do something for me, I want to help them. Dickie and Travis came over and Bobby came over and helped put siding up on my house. I don't know how to do that. And I was like, can I pay you guys something? Can I at least buy you lunch or something? Why? Because I feel indebted to them to do that. Helping and fixing incurs the feeling of debt to one another. Jesus calls us to serve one another. We serve each other not because something is broken or something is not right. We serve one another because we are holy. Let me say this again. We serve not because something is broken, but because something is holy. When we praise God, we praise Him because He is holy. When we serve God, we serve Him because He is holy. He is King. When I serve my neighbor, it's not because that person is broken or needs help. It's because that person in God's eyes is holy. And I serve him because he is holy. Now that might involve doing some things around the house and helping out and doing some things like that, but the reason I'm doing it is out of service to something and someone who is made holy in God's eyes. And that's what Jesus has called us to do. He called the apostles to serve one another. He calls us to serve one another out of a desire to serve Him. There is something profound relationship involved in service. Right? I can call in help. I can come over and fix you and never know anything about you. I cannot serve you unless I know you intimately. You ever wash anybody's feet? I think that's one reason why He did feet. Wash anybody's feet? You can't wash somebody's feet unless you know that person intimately. And can I take your shoes off this morning and clean in between your toes for you? We're going to have an intimate relationship if I do that, right? That's part of what Jesus, I think, is trying to tell us. It's only when we serve each other that we have an intimate relationship with one another. Now, that might be serving you by washing your feet, because you can't bend over and get to them like my mom is nowadays. Or that might be serving you by helping you get on your feet because you're having some rough times. Or that might be serving you by teaching you the word of the Lord because you don't know the good news from Jesus Christ. But I can't do any of that with a relationship with you. I've got to know you. I've got to serve you. Jesus says, I give you an example to follow. Serve one another. Church, I'm going to ask for your help. I've got to get better at this. I think we all need to get better at this probably. But it starts with me. And that's my prayer for us today. Let's pray. Father in God, We worship you because you are holy. You are holier than anything that we know. You are more righteous than anything that we can ever fathom. Your wisdom goes beyond our understanding. And yet, Father, in our brokenness and in our pain and in our sin, you come to us and draw us near you. Father, we ask, be the Lord of our life. We ask that you rule over us. We recognize you as God. We recognize your Son as Messiah. And we give our lives to you in service. Father, teach us to be servants to one another, not leaders who are serving because that's somehow the popular thing to do. Or leadership, servant leadership is the way to get things done. But Father, help us to know how to serve one another because we love one another, because we love you. Father, help us to recognize it's Passover all the time. Help us to recognize that your time is now. Help us to recognize the sacrifice and service you made for us as an equal, as a brother in your Son, our brother, serving one another so that we may serve others in the same way. Help us to have servants' hearts, not leaders. Move your Spirit powerfully among us that all may come to know your Son and his glory and the grace that you provide through him. We ask it in your Son's name. Amen. I know the elders want to be about that here. They want to help you to serve. They want to help you to serve another because that's what we're called to do. If there's any way that we can serve you today, if there's anything that we can do to help you down that path, now is the time to come as we stand and sing.